Meet the gang, cause the podcast is here, the podcast to entertain you. Greetings, podcats. Thank you very much for downloading this latest episode of Smooth Style No Bits. This is your host, Catherine Mary, hoping that you can hear me clearly over the buffeting wind. Thunder and lightning earlier, but that seems to have passed on now. Please tell your friends and family about these podcasts if you're enjoying them. Please tell the traffic warden as they give you a ticket. Please tell the person in the supermarket who comes to help you when the automatic checkout won't believe that you're old enough to buy wine. Please tell the mechanic who sniffs all the way through their conversation with you about that your tyres are bald and you really ought to consider buying some new ones at vast expense. Please tell everyone, because I really hope we can grow this community of listeners so that I can lure other people to come and be guests on the show for your entertainment and for my amusement, and they will be impressed by the number of you who are listening and enjoying, which I hope you are. So yes, your mission this week is to introduce the show to at least 400 other people in your circle. So crack on with that and report back. In the meantime, let's pod.
She's talking about the funny things that have her all in fits. She's ranting about the subjects that get right on her tits. She's chatting with the lovely folk and some who are real shits. It's Smooth Style No Bits. Smooth Style No Bits, it's a podcast.
Oh, you beautiful people, it's a joy to be back here with you after what seems like an age. But, of course, Christmas and the New Year came along and dropped a great big stitch in the normally beautiful rib of our lives. A little knitting metaphor there, gorgeous. And so now we get back to some more routine kind of life. Sometimes routine can be boring and terrible, but sometimes it can be a blessed relief after the madness of it all. Did you have a good time? I absolutely did. I have no idea what to expect. It was a crazy mix of people, but it worked. But yesterday the tree had to come down, the ornaments went back into their box, and it was a lovely thing. It was a pleasure to say goodbye to such an enjoyable couple of weeks of life. I think I gave you a report on most of what I was doing. The only thing I haven't told you about is the wonderful visit to see Wanted, Robin Hood, my brother's show that he was performing in at the Lowry Theatre in Salford in Manchester. What a contrast from other shows that I've seen this Christmas. I was just imagining a little sort of grid of comparing and contrasting the strengths and weaknesses of their various productions. It's quite difficult to speak my mind because every artistic performance is effort and energy and risk, and some of them come off and some of them don't, and so I have no desire to slag off anybody in an unhelpful way, but I think there's so much that was fantastic about the Robin Hood that I saw in Manchester, which was about Manchester and was properly rooted in the north of England and had something to say to those local people, which other shows I saw kind of didn't. And what kind of is pantomime is so many, particularly children's, only experience of first experience of the theatre, and for many adults it's the only theatre they see in the whole year. And I talked to my guest a little bit about that this week, and so I think giving it some sort of relevance is essential, really. I think it's... otherwise, what's the bloody point? While we were in Manchester, we stayed at the Holiday Inn Express in Salford Quays, which I can highly recommend. Nobody's paying me any money to say that, but I fully believe that it used to be a full-price hotel that has now started charging budget prices. So actually, it was a very pleasant hotel experience for 46 quid a room, which when you get four people in, is about £12 a person a night? Bloody good value, I say. I had a joyful Christmas with my darling sister who'd come over from California. I spent a lot of time worrying about keeping her warm, which was very funny. But yes, you would come downstairs to find her wearing her coat and a hat and gloves under a blanket at 11 o'clock in the morning. So I had to kind of bite the bullet and turn the heating on for her. God knows what that's going to do to the bill. But we'll all have a whip round for that, shall we, when it turns up. So that was Christmas. And now we're looking ahead to January. And what's on my mind? Well, I have been bracing myself to go to the barricades over the matter of school uniform. Does it surprise you to know that I'm thoroughly anti-school uniform? I think it's what those of us on my side of the argument like to call bollocks. I don't know what it's for. I think it speaks to some sort of English obsession, British obsession maybe, with the class system, with neatness and tidiness and control. Anyway, the dreaded letter appeared at the end of last term saying, just like to point out that we're going to be reaffirming our uniform rules come the beginning of term. It had bullshit statements about, you know, how many inches above the knee. Can you believe that? Inches above the knee? What am I in that? In a 19... Am I in Call the Bloody Midwife? Oh, anyway. Child needed a new school uniform anyway. So, but she has legs up for her armpits, if you know what I mean. So the chances of finding any skirt inches above the knee was a load of rubbish anyway. So her skirt goes very appropriate to this mother's line of thinking level. And anyway, what is it about women's bodies that are so... need to be controlled and covered up anyway? The other question was shoes. Lots of rules about shoes, including the fact that boots that went further up the leg than the top of the foot could not be worn unless under trousers. What? The child has been very happily wearing a pair of Dr. Martin boots to school for the last, I don't know, year? More than a year? Hard-wearing, comfortable... The child walks half an hour to and from school every day. Appropriate, don't make her feet hurt. She's got weird high arches. So I was kind of all ready to have a big old Barney about this and to become a battling mum who would go to the local paper and refuse to send her daughter to school and all that. But when their uniform was checked at school yesterday, nobody said a bloody word about the boots. So part of me thinks, well, I'm a bit sad that I didn't get to have my battle. But also, I'm grateful, really, because, you know, life's too short, really, for that kind of thing, anyway, isn't it? So, but it does mean that their bullshit rules are exactly that. A load of old poo on a piece of paper. What I would wish they would enforce is tell us what... give us some rules about makeup and to help with parents having conversations with their children about makeup at school. I do wonder if there are parents who would go on the down the road of parents who were slagging off Jamie Oliver, saying it's my child's right to wear chips, to eat chips. I do wonder whether there'd be parents who said it's my child's right to wear foundation and mascara. If we tried to go down that path, I'm not saying it's a problem particularly in this house. There have been days when I have looked over the top of my glasses in a slightly disapproving way at the child as it walks out the door and said, if I see you wearing that much eyeliner again, I will make you go upstairs and wash it off. So that's the kind of way I parent, through threats and fear and silence. It's the only way I know how. So what else is going on? Oh, I need some new TV to watch. Enjoying the new series of Sherlock. I know there was some hoo-ha over the wedding and that, and I do think that in this new series they have broadened things out. Obviously we've now got John's wife, who's played by his real wife. I didn't know that. I think she's lovely. I like that character. And also Molly, the assistant in the lab, has come to the fore. And I do wonder whether, a bit like how we definitely saw The Big Bang Theory, which started off as such a blokey show, actually realised that that was a mistake and opened itself up. And I do wonder whether there was a conscious decision to look at bringing the women to the fore. That's certainly what I see anyway. And I enjoy it. It's kind of family TV. We sit down together and I share it with my daughter, which is a lovely thing to have in the week. I wouldn't say it's massively, you know, if she wasn't into it, I might let it go by. Is that a terrible thing to say? Was excited by the new series of Silent Witness, but oh my God, that's just gone bonkers. I think those new characters are all awful and I hate all of them. And I can't be doing with it. Obviously, I was totally obsessed with Breaking Bad and Homeland, which I watched on the in the special ways, so that I saw episodes which were perhaps not available to all UK viewers. Some of you will know what I'm talking about, and some of you won't. I'm not going to incriminate myself on a podcast. So that was great, but they're over. Project Runway's nearly over. Oh, is anybody else watching Project Runway? I love that show. I'd watch it 24 hours a day. So what else is there for me? There doesn't seem... There's some bullshit drama about the Three Musketeers. Who bloody cares? And something that looks like a remake of Brief Encounter. People being sexy on a train. Again, not sure I can be bothered to care. So I don't know. I need something to become attached to. I like Appointment View. I like watching it live. And so maybe if you have any recommendations for me, or even things that perhaps that are from other countries which can be watched in the special ways that I don't know about, you could recommend those to me as well. Anyway, turning to our interview this week, I discovered very late in the day that Anna Carr, who I've only really got to know quite recently through a musical performance that we rehearsed up and got together, is moving to Manchester. So I wanted to grab her and talk to her for the podcast before she went. And as is just turning out to be the way, once you sit down and have an hour's uninterrupted conversation with any human being, people's lives are fascinating. We have a lot in common. We're both brought up in and around theatres and have a shared love for that, particularly the smell of them. And it was lovely to really spend some time with her. And as she said, when we left and discovered that we're meeting each other again at a meeting on Thursday at her house next Monday, and then we've arranged to meet in Manchester, she said, it's almost like we're friends. So here it is, my lovely conversation with the delightful Anna Carr. And what's taking you to Manchester then? Why Manchester?
I have been to Manchester on 3 or 4 occasions, and every time I've arrived at the train station, I've just felt...
Manchester Piccadilly. That's Manchester very glamorous as well, isn't it?
Yeah. It's quite romantic sounding, in a funny, industrious way.
Yeah.
I've just always felt that I could be there.
Yeah.
You know, when you turn up at places and you think, oh, I could live here.
Yes.
And it doesn't make much more sense than that, but that's very true.
Yes, it doesn't feel scary or difficult or anything. Yeah, it'd be fun. I could do this.
Yeah, exactly. And I've always been excited by that idea, and always sort of, I think where possibility can flower is a really good place for you to be.
Yeah.
So I've always felt good there. So that's simple reason. And then I've got two friends who I studied with at East 15 Drama School, who are there making theatre and studying theatre, and they're people that I would love to be able to work with and be surrounded by, and I know that they would want to support me in what I want to do.
Yeah.
So
you made a little reference there to East 15. Well, that's news to me. I didn't know that for a start. We haven't actually known each other very long, have we?
We haven't, and we have, right?
Because I know your face well.
That's it. It's the face culture, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
So I remember being sat at Peter Rhodes bookshop when I was 17. 17, because I'm now 27.
27, you see, I didn't even know how old you were.
And I was writing with my dear friend Alice a play about Boudicca.
Right.
And Peter Rhodes happened to be the place where there were all these bizarre books about, with different accounts of who this woman was.
Right.
And at the time, you had your little...
We had a shop downstairs at that point. We were in the basement earlier.
And so I remember sort of seeing you come in and out, I think in dungarees.
Gosh.
Or blue overalls. And I remember sort of popping downstairs every now and then and just having a little look at some of your clothes.
How funny. Oh, no, you see, I don't go back as far as... I can't sort of say that I remember you from that time. But I sort of feel like I know you just from... I don't know, just being out at maybe at a gig or something. I've always known you as a theatre-y person or a, you know, drama performer-y sort of person. And I don't know why I know that, but I guess it's just, you do maybe just clock people without even realising you're doing it. I go, oh, look, it's her. She's again, that one.
And there's a way of relating. So I remember buying my coat from you when you had Hep Rights as well. But before then, you emceed, this was quite an interesting, the Women's Day night at the Art House.
I've been asked to do it again!
Hooray!
I'm so excited!
Oh.
It's in a very exciting venue this year, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say. I must check with the Art House whether I'm allowed to say. But yes, I was very flattered that I've been asked to compare it again. No, I'm not saying. This is a public broadcast. This is. Do you understand how podcasts work? People are actually going to listen to this. But I think it'd be quite nice if they announced it. I'm not aware that it's on Facebook or anything yet.
Okay.
So I'll let them say.
How exciting.
I'll tell you privately.
The tension.
In a minute. Yeah, you have to come back from Manchester.
I will.
Anyway, so what, you saw that, didn't
you? So I saw that. I came to that and that was my first ever, that was the first event I ever went to at the Art House.
Right.
And was it 2 years ago? It was where Angela...
Probably.
So Angela Chicken was
doing poetry
that night. And you were the master of ceremonies.
Gobby was doing her thing.
But it was great. It was really great. And it was hearing Angela Chicken do her poetry that made me think, oh my gosh, what's this? And could I ever write on that night?
Does she know that?
She does now.
Hey,
yeah, she knows it. Because, she was someone who I completely, as soon as I heard her words, they just resonated.
Right.
And I found them really relatable. And... I sort of developed a real admiration for her whenever she was in the room. I was like, oh, Angela Chicken.
I've worshipped that woman for 25 years, so I wouldn't.
Yeah.
She will be on the podcast
soon.
Of course, both being single parents of school-aged children, we find it impossible to spend any time in each other's company. So, now that school is back, holidays are over, we are working very hard on getting her in for a chin win.
And you lived together once, didn't you?
We did. Yes, that was... really where our friendship blossomed was watching horror movies in the afternoons. when I worked at the Nuffield Theatre in the wardrobe department, Angela was very good friends with Stephen, who was the head of wardrobe. And so when Stephen and I used to share a flat, and then a room came up in Angela's house, and she said, you're looking for a place, how about it? And that was about in 1985 or something.
And how long...
We've known each other ever since.
When did you stop working at the Nuffield?
Oh, I did two. I was in wardrobe for a year and I was stage management for a year.
Oh, wow.
Stage management purloined me from wardrobe.
Gosh.
Yeah, which is quite an interesting career trajectory now I think about it. Anyway, this is not about me. Somebody will have to come and have me in the middle of the podcast sometime. People want to get my story out.
That would be great.
But yes. We're all still friends. All that gang. Stephen has been working for the West Yorkshire Playhouse for years. He's just leaving that. He's lives with his husband, who's a tattoo artist, rather famous tattoo artist, and they're just moving house.
Hmm.
And of course his house will be fabulous and glamorous because, hey, he's a fabulous and glamorous person.
Sure.
So, back to you. So, you are a local woman.
I am a local.
You're born in Southampton.
I was born in Southampton.
Yeah, you see, we're a rare breed.
We are.
Although you're leaving. Traitor.
But I will always return.
She will always return.
You really
will always see you here. So you're 27. So tell me a bit about life about your family life.
I have a twin brother.
Oh, do you now?
I have a twin brother who is a journalist for the Daily Echo.
Right.
Now.
Is he called Carr as well?
He is called Carr as well. Michael Carr.
Michael Carr.
Michael Carr. And he's now taken...
Ask him if he wants to come be on podcast.
Yeah, sure, of course I will.
That would be great.
I was about to say, he's taken to... He's, for the first time in our life together, we are getting on miraculously well because I'm able to tell him about the quirky things that are happening in Southampton that otherwise...
Oh, I see, you're a useful source of news.
I am, I am. And it's meaning that our relationship is the best it's ever been.
Aww.
Which is really lovely, yeah. So that's him. And we had a rather turbulent childhood.
So you were the sort of punching each other kind of brother-sister relationship?
Yes. Yes. You know, I would pull hair, I think. I'd pull hair and bite, and, and he would kick and pummel.
Oh, lovely. I'm sure your parents had a marvellous
My lucky, lucky parents. And I had a fantastic scream that would, you know,
shatter the window.
But it's stuff of life. Yes, so, and I have a father who is a Tibetan Buddhist,
right,
and a mother who is a Quaker. And my parents used to run a business English language school in their house,
right.
So we'd have clients.
Are you a Highfield girl?
No, I went to Portswood Primary School.
So you're over that way,
Belmont Road.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone shall know.
Everyone shall know Belmont Road. Yeah.
Yes, so that was my, you know, trajectory of the up. Up Grosvenor to Portswood School every day and back
with the
Portswood gang of peeps.
And so so your mum's the Quaker and your father's a Buddhist. Are they both still around?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And together?
Together, just about. We're slightly like a multi-occupancy household. We've all got our space within the house.
How marvellous. Well, that's probably why everybody's all still together and speaking.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very, very valid point.
And so, had your parents both come from these traditions, or were they, had they taken on their Quakerness and their Buddhistness?
My mum found her Quaker faith, if you will, from
a Quakerosity. I'm sure there must be a more better word.
Quakerism.
Yes, probably.
From her mother,
right,
and father, and they lived in Southampton. That was what brought my mum to Southampton.
There's a whole Quaker thing that goes on in Southampton, isn't there? That
it's a very humble little community.
Of course, as Quakers are.
Wonderfully. Yeah, but it's also, you know, I've sort of been through the years and I just, people just get older, seems to be the way of it. So sort of faces that I knew when I was a, you know, a five-year-old girl, and they were maybe in their 50s, or they're now in their 70s.
Do Quakers, you know, have a regular sort of weekly practice? Is there like going to church on a Sunday kind of equivalent?
Yeah,
or is
so it's Quaker meeting.
Flexi.
It's Quaker meeting. Quaker meeting happens between 10:45 and 11:45 on a Sunday.
Right.
And it is a glorious hour of silence.
Yeah.
In a circle. And if people feel moved to speak or reflect momentarily, then they rise and do so, and you know, you can, it's a very, very open, non-hierarchical space, which I think my mum appreciates, and I think people that find it really appreciate, because there isn't a sense of a creed and there isn't a sense of words that you must say.
But still defined as Christian, I'm not sort of quite clear about that.
Yeah, based, I think it came out of, I ought to know my Quaker history better, but I think it came out of the Christian tapestry. I think it's known as a branch of Christianity, but the idea of God is very loose, and it's this idea about light.
Oh, this is hugely appealing. I want to go. I want to be in the Quaker meeting now. Be in the light. Oh, my God.
You should have an hour of silence and then podcast about it. Or maybe an open podcast.
That would be amazing. An hour of silence podcast. That would be incredible.
Yeah.
Gosh, anyway. I wonder if there are Quaker podcasts. Let's have a look.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. An area to go into. And with my dad, he only found Tibetan Buddhism... how old am I now? About 15 years ago.
So you were a child?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how did that sort of manifest itself in the house? Was this suddenly... Dad shave his head and put on orange robes?
No, he's not a monk. He's no monk. So my brother had a hard time growing up because he has Asperger's syndrome.
Right.
And I think
this is your twin.
This is my twin brother.
Any other brothers and sisters?
A half brother and a half sister.
Okay, we'll come on to that.
And
right, so difficult times for your brother.
Yes.
And then rippling through the family. I mean, it's tough when
it is.
You know, one person's dealing with their own challenges. It ricochets around.
It does. And I think it's been hard for my parents to understand that. I don't know. I think we all maybe have elements of Asperger's and autism in us. And so we can all be very set about how things should be. And I think my father comes from a very, very sort of disciplined, this is the way that you act in society. This is how you need to be. This is how considerate you need to be of other people. And my brother just doesn't have that in his
trying to bring up your child
to do that. And so it's very hard,
just
I think.
Pushing against
and
huge tide that's going completely the other way.
Exactly. And so that environment was very hard, I think, for both, for everyone involved. And I think Tibetan Buddhism gave him this sense of peace and kind of allowed him to explore not being so attached to his own waves, to my dad's own waves of kind of emotions.
Do you perceive that it was that investigation that took him there was about coping and addressing the unhappinesses that were in
house? And I think I have memories of my dad being very frightening as a child.
Right.
Because his temper would sort of
so that frustration
surge.
Would just completely overwhelm.
Yeah. And I think that would also have a knock-on effect on my brother, Michael, as well. So, you know, it was something that really addressed that and allowed that to sort of be calmed.
And how is that for you? I mean, we're maybe going into bits of your life that you don't want to talk about, so tell me if that's the case, and I will change the subject. But you are not only the sister of this person, you are the twin sister of this person. So how is the focus on him and the frustration or, you know, dealing... Sorry, brother, if you're listening to this, but I'm sure as an adult you have more perspective on it now. What sort of implication is that having on you with such a spotlight drawn to your brother and the electric anger crackle that it generated in the house?
A few things. I think as a child growing up, and only now am I realising that I'm very scared of anger.
Right.
I think also it's what fed the theatre, actually.
Right.
Because theatre is a space where you can explore those things and that you can speak. I think as a child I was very silent because Michael took up so much energy.
Yeah.
And there was so much sort of, using the word turbulence again, but there was so much around that. And if I ever did interfere, I would be shot down and it would make the situation worse.
So your coping strategy was just to withdraw and be quiet and try not to be seen, maybe?
Yes, to be seen, not to be seen, but of course, as a child, you do hear everything.
Of course.
But you see, we also had in the house wonderful lodgers who would come and be in things like Solent People's Theatre and the Gantry and the Nuffield, who would come and stay in our houses whenever we didn't have clients from either Spain or wherever.
Doing the thing.
And I think
you were theatrical digs.
Exactly. And I think that was a really wonderful way out for me.
How interesting.
And I got to see so much theatre.
Yes, I was thinking. So you say, yeah, come along. I'll get you tickets. Come and see this. Come and see that.
It just became. I remember being taken around the Nuffield when I was really little and just wanting to be part of that world. Just
do you know what
so...
I love? The smell of theatres.
Yeah.
God, I love the smell of theatres.
You know, that's my home and it's...
That's my happy place in childhood. Yeah. It's indescribable, isn't it? But you could walk me into a place with my eyes shut and I'd say, I am backstage in a theatre.
Yeah. And you know, and there's something so comforting about that darkness.
Hugely.
Right? Because it's strange, isn't it? That, you know, we can be very scared of the dark, but the dark in a theatre is not scary.
Also, the dark backstage is a womb.
A womb.
You know, the darkness of being in the auditorium is completely different. I remember taking a friend's two kids to the pantomime, one who was about 5 and one who was about 8. And as the lights started going down, the 5-year-old lost it. He just panicked and started kicking. He had to get out. It was like, what are you, you know, like I was taking him underwater or something. I don't think, because you're backstage and you have that wonderful glow and energy from what's going on stage, and you're part of it but not part of it, and all the jokes that go on, and also that fantastic sense of, I love that silent team.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
That everybody knows their thing.
And where else does it happen?
And you can just be nods and winks and and there's the dresser doing incredible things there, and stage manager's there, and the person on the book here, and there's an actor absolutely shitting themselves about to go on stage. And
It's so exciting. It's so alive, isn't it? So alive.
And there's I don't know, less and less people who get the get access to it. I think that's an interesting connection that I can make, because for so many people, the theatre is this. Well, it's this massive special occasion thing, you know, once every year or less. Whereas I think probably, definitely for me and probably for you as well, going to the theatre is a really normal thing to do.
Yeah.
You think, oh, Wednesday night, I've got nothing on. I know, I'll go and see whatever's at the... Like you might go to the cinema, or you might go to the pub. You think, well, I might go and spend 20 quid in the pub, I'll go to the theatre.
Yeah, absolutely.
And... obviously, you drag your child with you and make her go and see things that she's... Although she's seen some... You know, she's a bit of a Shakespeare fan, my 14-year-old. Oh, yes, she's seen some very good Shakespeare in her time. Yes, she's going to be a West End musical star.
Right.
Yes, very, very focused on that moment.
Right.
Which is fine by me. That'd be a very hard life, but fine by me. So, yes, you two had this wonderful privilege of being connected to theatre. So did you get into... you know, the amateur dramatics and all that?
I was in junior operatic society from the age of 7 to 13
or 14. Seven, my God, really young. What shows did you do?
Princess Ida was my first, which is the GNS, Gilbert and Sullivan.
Aww.
And then, gosh, what came after that? We did an old-time music hall.
Nobody does those anymore.
I love them. About that. They were great. And I learned all these songs.
Yes.
You know, at the age of 8.
Yes.
Any Old Iron.
My like, old man. Yes. Yeah. Follow the band. I know.
And some were really
the
heartbreaking.
The boy I love sitting in. But they're like, that's like, I mean, that's 100 years ago now. That's very, very old.
And it's such a different sense of childhood that you're relating to. It's such a completely different time for children. It's very odd. But I loved that. And I loved dressing up and being put into these old clothes of a different time. And makeup. My God, I loved having my face painted.
And were you getting sort of leading roles in these shows? Or were you a...
No.
Ensemble, it's called.
Ensemble.
That's nice,
I've always been ensemble.
Not chorus,
minded.
Ensemble.
But, you know, I was young. I remember there was one... I remember learning certain things when I went to these... rehearsals, and you know that there was this real sense that there were many children that wanted to be in the front, and that kind of wanted to have that, and if you wanted to be that role, you really had to run for it.
Was ever thus.
And I've never been very good at that. I've always been the sort of you go before me kind of person, and that has taken me all the way. Even at drama school, it would be that way, and that's something that I'm only kind of beginning to learn to kind of...
Did you know it at the time? Did you observe yourself doing it? You know, that's fine. You want it, you have it. I'm not going to fight for it. When actually, if challenged, you do want it. You're just not. You're not up for the fight.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that sort of that fear of conflict, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I don't think I recognised it growing up, but I think from that sort of intense time at drama school, where there is so much, you know, competition is really there again, I think I could see it. But it's only now that I'm able, with poetry, that I'm trying to encourage myself to put myself forward more.
Yeah.
But at the time, with a group of other youths, it was harder.
Yes, absolutely. And obviously kind grown-ups thinking, oh, well, she's one of the, you know, she doesn't like them, we'll put her. My daughter's problem is that she's tall. And so she's massively taller than the other kids. She's massively taller than the boys. Mm. So the tendency is to put her at the back. And so, and she knows, she's noticed this. And so it's, I'm pleased to say it's, she comes home furious and saying, I danced my bloody ass off tonight because I was determined to show them that, you know, it's really, it's got some fire in her belly.
That's good.
So I think it'll, I don't sort of worry that it's oppressing her, but no. it's making her to quite a feisty individual,
that's fantastic.
I think. Yeah, it's good. It's better that way than feeling, oh, I stick out and I'm all wrong. And So, how, when did the decision to try for drama school come? Did you, did it, was it a sort of logical progression, or did it,
was it,
did you like choose your A-levels knowing that's the way you were going to go? And
no, I didn't. I think at each stage I just knew I wanted to spend more of my time doing that.
So you just kept moving towards, and actually, not knowing what was at the end of it.
And here's a funny link. I remember doing the first, I remember doing Treasure Island at the Nuffield back when Colin McAllister stepped in. Years and years ago.
Oh my God, the wheels were the worlds of worlds. Yeah. Colin was the first, my first podcast guest.
Yes, absolutely. And he had to step in because the captain in Treasure Island somehow
Didn't they injure themselves or something?
Or maybe he somehow got a booking for a film as well or something.
I don't know. Anyway,
took that.
Maybe the accent was a bit of a lie.
And by that age, I was in year 10, I was 14 going on 15, and I'd managed to get into this Christmas panto, and I wanted to spend my time there at the theatre. I didn't want to have to go back to school. And I think I had this battle with my parents because I wanted to be, you know, I loved being busy every evening and doing different kind of outside of school activities, and they were like, no, you should be spending your time
homework, blah blah blah.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, if you feel like you're being bulldozed into doing the homework, then, you know, you might not do it. So
how was your brother's schoolwork faring at the time?
Did he
you know, do what school wants you to do, was he?
Yeah, he did bare minimum and got, and you know, I hope he won't feel.
No, he's a fully
grown adult, isn't he?
A grown adult with a job, which is more than you and I are.
Yeah, I know, right? And he's earning more than anyone in our family.
Well, there you go.
He's great, which is really good for him. So he always got by. I think he struggled at the beginnings of school and at the beginnings of secondary school, particularly year 7 at Cantel. Because there were just so many changes going on.
And change and the scale of it all in that,
yeah. But by the time that we were that age, I think he was just sort of, he had what he loved, which was his PlayStation, his Xbox and playing football. And, you know, they were his themes at the time. And as long as he was able to do those things, you know, and he wasn't stopped from doing those things, things were okay, I think.
Yeah.
For him. For me, I think I got really excited about being able to choose to do drama at GCSE and that having that choice.
Yeah.
And then the same thing at sixth form. And I did performance studies at Peter Simmons College.
Yeah.
And the guy who was the head of it at the time was intense and demanded a lot from...
What was his name?
The student, Alan Duffield. And, you know, he was the kind of man that, you know, you either really respected or people would fight against, or sort of, you know, kind of...
Yeah, saying, oh, he's a Mr. Duffield,
yeah. But I loved it.
You're going, no, challenge me!
Yeah, exactly.
Demand things of me.
Yeah, and I love that. And I think that's what took me into the drama school way, because I sort of thought, well, I want to be doing 30, 35 hours a week minimum of this. I don't want to be doing 10 hours at a university with people that don't really know whether this is what they want to do.
And so what was the applying to drama school process like? Were you straight from A-levels?
No, and I didn't apply straight away. Another thing that happened was that I got glandular fever at the end of my A-levels, and I had planned to go on a gap year and spend like 7 months in Malawi. I had to cancel my gap year plans. And all my friends went swanning off into university, and I went
bye. And you lay on a sofa
and withered away. Yeah, for months.
My sister had it, so
it's a very tricky thing. So I don't think before you get that, you really understand, or anyone really understands, what it is, what that tiredness is, what that kind of state of depression is, where you're just
weak.
Yeah, and your energy just doesn't go further than 5 minutes, sort of. And so that was a big reverse in my life.
So you were at home, you were on your parents' sofa being brought soup?
For a summer, and then I ended up having to do a third year at Taunton's College the year after, but I could barely commit to that because I was just so tired.
So that was like 2 years, really, the glandular fever took?
It took one year, and then the gap year plans that I cancelled, I was able to do the following year.
Right.
So I went to Africa and spent time in Tanzania and places learning, teaching people with learning disabilities English and that kind of thing. But the drama school application was odd, I think, because I think that my idea of theatre or what I want to do in theatre isn't as simple as I want to act and for the rest of my life I want to act. I sort of feel like, well, I want to create, I want to teach, I want to do many, many things. And in when I applied for RADA and when I applied for Lambda, that was really obvious in the auditions. I could tell that they were sort of wanting a particular answer from me, and I wasn't able to give them that answer. So at the same time as that, there was a course that was being advertised at East 15 called World Performance, and that was kind of advertising all these an introduction to all these different performing art forms from different parts of the world.
Sounds
very sexy. And it was interesting and open, and I sort of actually was starting to feel that a lot of drama schools were very, very, very closed. And so I was really, I sort of felt that given who I was at that age, at the age of 20 there, and the kind of experiences that I'd had, I felt in a position where I could learn a lot more and get a lot more from a course that was much more broad.
Yeah. And how, so you applied and you got in? I mean, what was the audition process like?
Well, it was the first course of its kind. And so...
Gosh, so you must have been a really odd, wonderfully odd collection of people coming together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, but not only that, I mean, so many people try and get into drama school now. It's such a competitive process. And so there were quite a lot of people on my course that had tried to get into acting and hadn't got in, and so were offered this course. So there were quite a few.
You're not really supposed to be here.
No, and they would feel that too.
Why are we doing this morning of African dancing?
Yes, that's exactly it. And so that was quite hard, I think, for some of the tutors and some of the people that did, like myself, want to be there.
Oh, yes. writhing around on the floor, expressing yourself.
Exactly. Through a different medium. Exactly. But I remember the process itself, because I was actually in an audition for another course there, which was physical theatre. And I don't know, I think that's one of the things that I've realised, is that I'm interested in so many things.
Yeah.
That it is really, really hard to pick one thing and not let yourself sort of develop. I mean, there was also a course at East 15 in community theatre, and I'd love to do that too, and I really like the physical theatre course.
Well, maybe you will, said the 50-year-old woman. I mean, you know, there's a lot of life.
There is, right?
It's not like everything has to be challenged through this one university. I didn't go to university until I was 35, you know.
Really? And what did you do?
I did an MBA. I did a business degree. I'd been in business for a long time, and then I just made it all up as I went along, and ended up doing glamorous high class things involving lots of money, and just thought, oh Jesus, I'd really quite like to have some actual proper skills in this.
Okay.
So I went and did an MBA, which was great. It was really interesting. And I just did it, but usually people do an MBA as a part time thing while they're working. Mm-hmm. But I just pushed it into a year. So there was a little group of us all doing this MBA in a year, very intense. Mm-hmm. And we'd all get together and do our homework together. Oh, it was lovely. And read highfalutin texts. Oof. About international issues. I loved it.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. Wow. Yeah, as you see, now I'm sitting on my sofa doing a podcast, so even doing an MBA doesn't necessarily, you know. It's just, you just
just do.
If we're in this incredibly privileged, you know, the middle class world of having options,
absolutely.
Being able, and you know, particularly at 27 when you're single and childless and all the rest of it, you've got the freedom of the world to just, you know, muck about, do what pleases you. I mean, it's, yeah, so you will do your community drama course, or be careful because it will turn you into Colin McAllister, which is a bit of a, you know,
of course he
to
did
be
that.
Avoided at all costs.
Colin
going
Calif-
back round the houses.
Wow.
So East 15 is in East 15, is it? Makes you an East Ender?
No, I studied in Southend. Southend on
Sea. Oh, I love Southend.
Essex. Do you?
Love Southend.
So, yeah, they built up a whole new campus there.
Right.
And the studios, oh my God, the studios were literally looking out onto the sea.
How fabulous.
Amazing.
Why do I know about Southend? I feel like my mum worked there. My mother was an actress.
Okay.
Is there a theatre in Southend?
There is. Oh God. Clifton. I want to say Clifton.
Yes!
The
Clifton Theatre?
Yeah.
I think maybe she worked there.
Anyway,
that doesn't matter. But
it's a real,
I'm trying to work out why I've ever been to Southend. But
it's a very much Mayflower type venue, I would say, the Clifton.
A big one like that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
There was a couple.
So when did you leave drama school then?
2011.
So not long ago. Three years.
Yeah,
so after,
2.5 years.
A-levels, illness, Africa, drama school.
Yeah.
Takes us through,
yeah,
that kind
two.
Of first decade of,
yeah,
the 2000s, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so since you've been out of drama school, what have you been doing?
Well, I did a project. The first thing I did was a project that took me to Greece for a week. I took part in this like live arts symposium. Devised a promenade piece that took place in an abandoned hotel, and it was taking,
oh my God, it sounds amazing.
It was taking audience members through this kind of tourist package, but actually what we were taking them through was the journey that a young under 18 migrant goes through when they're you know, trying to get to this newfangled sort of Western life that doesn't exist.
Right.
So I took part in that, and then I went to Poland for a month because I got really taken with this kind of a very intense, visceral Song of the Goat, which is like a Polish theatre company, that are very, very total theatre, sort of all-encompassing music and
right.
Rhythm and body and voice, and it's a very much a kind of, you know, a real, it's seamlessly in between sort of polyphonic choral song and then heightened Shakespeare, but that.
So is it all, is it quite, do the companies sort of live and work together? Is it that kind of idea?
Yeah, and very ensemble based. And I'd basically been to see a show at the Barbican, at Macbeth, and it was like Macbeth without any walls, if that makes sense, without any sort of sense of there being different rooms. And it was kind of not necessarily linear, but I had the most human response to the story and felt so moved, more moved than I had felt by Shakespeare before. And then I think also I've had quite a musical upbringing, and it kind of brought those kinds of things together for me, and I really wanted to find out more. And I got a taste of it at East 15 for sort of like a couple of weeks, but I wanted to go and work with this company, so I took myself off to Poland for a month and did, you know, hardcore workshops 5 days a week for a month. And it was very, very physically opening process, because it's a very sort of break yourself down, run for 2 hours a day and then all sorts of things type experience. So I did that, and then I felt very confused because I was no longer a student, I was a graduate, but I didn't know what I was. I didn't know if I was an actor, a director, a writer. I just knew that I'd finished something that had been very, very massive. And I knew I really needed to take some time. So I decided...
and earn a living.
not quite yet. No, I decided... one of my salvations were in my final year at East 15 was gardening. So I would take myself home for a weekend and I would just be in the garden and I would dig and weed and plant.
Was that a new thing? Or
really
your,
new.
Yeah?
Really new. Are
your parents gardeners?
My dad's a gardener.
Right.
And my grandpa was a gardener and my grandma was a gardener. And it just felt like a place of returning somehow. I think I've always been quite earthy.
Yeah.
And really, really happy with my fingers in the soil. And, you know, suddenly you make all... Life makes sense somehow when you're looking at a flower bed for a long time and clearing the weeds
well,
from
and
it.
Partly sort of if you feel it,
yeah.
Well, really don't question it. That's
no,
fine.
Just,
there's
yeah.
really absolutely no need to discuss
yeah.
why.
And it's therapy and it's helping. And so it really
do.
Did. And so I sort of thought, you know, particularly in your final year, I was being asked lots of questions about what you're going to do next and where are you going. Da, 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 da. And I felt like, okay, if nothing else happens... in this sort of whatever happens next thing, then I'll just go to France and I'll learn French and I will do woofing, which is this working on organic farms.
Yes, yes.
And I'll find out more about sustainability.
Yeah.
So that's what I did.
Whereabouts in France?
Everywhere.
Oh, really? Well, you sort of hop from farm.
Place to place, from experience to experience. Some places I ran away from.
Yeah.
Kicking...
experience,
yeah.
Run away from those experiences.
Yeah, God, no, yeah, you have to. And other places, I mean, yeah, so I sort of started north and started off in a kind of it was like an eco village, doing kind of putting hay insulation into a wooden house.
Mm-hmm.
And working out that I definitely wasn't a builder.
Not going to be doing that.
Never.
So are you getting your room and board, or are you getting a bit of money as well, or
Room and board?
Yeah,
that's it. In exchange for your work.
Yeah.
So I started off in Brest and then went to a cider farm and picked apples for 2 weeks, which was just wonderful. And then I went.
Oh, lovely time of year, I'd imagine,
yeah.
as well. Just to be.
Yeah, it's sort of September, October, and kind of really gorgeous, really, really gorgeous. And I was, you know. Taking in this new language, which was just great, so good, and it totally took me back to what learning is.
Yeah,
away from theatre and away from that kind of competition and ego. Although you do meet your own ego when you're learning. So yes, I did that for 3 months and worked out that I was really missing theatre, and then came back and kind of. Hopped from project to project. I did this sort of observership with this company called Tamasha, who did a play called Snookered, which was about sort of second generation Muslim men growing up in their 20s, and was back in a sort of professional rehearsal room again, which felt really, really good. And then I also found myself in this theatre collective called Teatro di Nascosto, which means hidden theatre in Italian. And that was sort of theatre and human rights, which I had a real interest in, sort of merging those two worlds together, but didn't know how, and had this opportunity to find out more. And so I worked with this company for 6 months, which culminated in going to Palestine and presenting a piece about hidden voices and people that have been sort of affected by war. At this theatre called the Freedom Theatre and taking part in this sort of international youth theatre festival in the West Bank, which was a very eye-opening experience. Yes. So I did lots of hopping around for about a year based on doing those kinds of things. Also working at the Nuffield, ushering and doing bar work. And then by September last year, 2012, I felt I needed to stay still.
Yeah.
For a while.
So Mum and Dad's house had been the only fixed sort of
yeah.
point that you kept sort of going
running
yes,
to from
coming
yeah.
back to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And gosh, what's happened since that September?
Well, I saw you in the show at the Gurkha Museum.
Yes, you did.
Which was fabulous and really very sort of smack in the facey. Like, oh my God, this sort of like this. This sort of stuff doesn't happen in my city, in my place. This is of this sort of substance and realness. And again, we were talking before we started recording about localness and proper connectivity with real people and real ideas that are really are, you know, meaningful to us at where we live and the times we live in.
Yeah.
Which was a fabulous, fabulous piece of theatre that happened in this, what's it called? Like the dining room or something? At the Gurkha Museum in Winchester. So you're in this incredibly smart room full of glass cases with polished ceremonial ram horns and sugar bowls and cigar cutters and things. And then there's you lot doing this all this piece about, you know, the women who were left behind in a time of war. And, well, that just blew my bloody mind, that did. Mm-hmm. Blew my bloody mind. Mm-hmm. So how did you get involved in that?
That was because... How did I meet Deborah? I did a rehearsed
That's
reading.
Deborah Gearing, That's Deborah who's Gearing. a local writer.
You should totally get on your podcast.
I'm working on her.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, you can help. Pincer movement.
Yes, indeed. So I did a rehearsed reading at the Nuffield for in September, and she came to that. And we spoke after the event, and she told me that she was...
But why did you do a rehearsed reading? Who did a rehearsed reading?
Why did I do rehearsed reading?
Of her play?
No, sorry.
Something else.
So there was a series of rehearsed readings that were being performed at the Nuffield over a week by up and coming writers.
I see. So it came out of the writers. So it used to be presumably.
Yes, it did. Right. And a friend of mine called Barney, who had a play, and there was a part in it that he sort of offered me to rehearse to read on the stage, and so I did that at the Nuffield during that week, and she came to that, and through that we met, and then she sort of saw me working behind the bar afterwards,
and that connection was made. Yeah.
Yes, and so she told me that she was in the process of beginning to write at Troy with Fiona Mackie, and said, you know, give me your contact details. And, you know, would you like to come and audition for it?
and
that was it. I think once I'd made the decision to stay in Southampton, things like that happened.
Yes.
So I sort of got rehearsed readings there, and I got rehearsed readings at The Point and the Berry Theatre to do with their writing group. And I also, God, did 2 weeks, two, 3 weeks of sort of three shows a day of this thing called Davy Jones's Locker, which was in the Nuffield... bar, and it was this sort of immersive interactive experience for 3 to 7 year olds.
Three shows a day. That's been exhausted.
Yeah 45 minutes of just taking these children on an adventure
around
Davy Jones's locker. And
don't you find that in my time working as a stage manager, once you're doing three shows a day, you forget which show you're on.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
have
yeah.
we done that bit yet?
Yeah.
Are we before the interval or after the interval?
Yeah.
Or have I done that cue? Have I not done that? Drives
it's
you bonkers
just, it's
after
a, cycle
a while.
And the space in your head only...
Yeah. Yes, only you are only a Davy Jones's Locker. Not everywhere.
Nothing else. You know, eating is such a sort of... you know, you squeeze it in and you sleep.
Oh, that must have been wonderful. Now my kids are a bit older, I miss out on all that wonderful world of little children's theatre.
And it's so exciting.
Which I love.
Yeah.
And
it's
still great.
Love. You see, whenever I can, I try and get a free ticket to go and see something.
Oh, I would.
And,
every time.
But it still appeals to me. And I, you know, I think it's a very odd thing that we make the separation between children for theatre, I mean, theatre for children and theatre for adults, because I think that...
Exactly, yes. I can think of the wonderful work of Martin, Sue Eaton and Martin Bridle,
yes.
who work as hand-to-mouth theatre,
yes.
who are the most beautiful puppeteers you ever
yeah.
saw in your life. And every time I see anything they do, it makes me want to cry because they just bring such life and such humour and such beauty to... Have you seen Piggery Jokery?
No,
I haven't.
Oh,
my God, it's hysterical.
Okay.
About these pigs getting fatter and fatter and fatter. And then eventually it's bacon and sausages. And funniest thing you ever saw.
Wow.
Funniest I love it. I'm very sad, and they know this. Martin Bridle is considered to be one of the best Punch and Judy professors.
Because he came to my school.
In Britain. And I have, and he sort of stopped doing it.
Yeah.
And then occasionally this show comes back out. I'm a Punch and Judy nut. I built a whole Punch and Judy.
Oh,
I made Punch
wow,
and Judy
covers.
Honestly, it's ridiculous. I got totally obsessed with them. Never performed it. That didn't seem to be. I don't know what I was doing at the time.
Interesting.
But I needed to do. I needed to make these puppets. I needed.
Wow.
To make these puppets.
And so you did.
And I'm still very sad that I've never seen his Punch and Judy.
Oh my gosh. We need to find a way to bring it back.
I have seen one of the few, I've met one of the few women Punch and Judy professors, a wonderful woman called Wendy Wareham, who was the Punch and Judy on Swanage Beach for years.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And I went and met her, and she is fabulous. She lives in India a lot of the time and has relationships with deeply unsuitably young Indian men.
Okay.
Oh, she's marvellous. She's everything I aspire to be. Anyway, so, I mean, my God, Anna, this is an incredible... I mean, you are an extremely industrious person. Do you know this about yourself?
No.
No.
I never feel like I'm doing anything or doing enough.
Enough. What's that about? Things you want to do? Or is there a voice saying, you're wasting your time, you lazy bastard. This is no sensible way for a grown-up to behave.
Yes, I think that I get all involved in, you know, the nature of so many creative careers is that they're all involving and all-encompassing, but for like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And then how do you
and
recover
then,
from that? Sudden, you know.
My brother said to me, my brother is also an actor, and I went to see him in Robin Hood, as we were talking about earlier, and he was saying, oh yeah, it's great, because I'm going to be staying on, and I'm doing this production of The Seagull, and then, semi-jokingly, he said, and then I'll never work again. And you think, you are 55, you have made your life as an actor for more, you know, but inevitably there will be this period now where he will never work again. Oh God, it's all awful. What is my life? Then those of us who love him dearly, just we just have to live through this time with him now. Very glad I'm not his partner. So it is a huge emotional.
It is, and
the ups and downs.
You know, my worst question, the question I sort of wriggle with the most, is the "What are you doing?" question.
Oh,
I hate that question so much. Because also I find it's you know, that it's also quite hard to explain to people when you're in the midst of a project or when something's finished and it's over, kind of what it was.
Yes.
If they had no kind of stake in it or...
I think quite often when people ask those questions, because I go through that as well, I've done lots of seemingly very unrelated things. They've been sort of punctuated in the last 10 years with you know, long periods of serious illness. And often I think what people mean is, how do you live? Where do you get your money from? Often I think that's quite a lot behind it. And sometimes I think there can almost be some envy in that question. How do you manage to do this?
Yeah.
How can you go to Poland for 3 months and then...
Sure.
And if they could just say, so, did you get paid? Or did you work? Or did you get free? But we're all a bit polite. And I don't know, does that resonate?
I think it does. And
people
don't
ask that question.
And that many people, that's the thing, is that many people do have that sort of staple, that this is what they're doing and this is what they've made their commitment to. Do you know what I mean? That sort of being married to a job or kind of...
I am an accountant.
Yeah.
I drive a taxi, and that's understandable. It's clear.
It's
we all know what that means.
Four words, you know.
Doesn't really.
And it's a question
need any more explanation.
No, exactly. Whereas
I wonder if people who do sort of like there's a guy who lives a street away from, and I don't think he does live there anymore. But anyway, he'd always say something to do with, "Oh, I work in food. I think that's what he said. Turned out what he actually did was he's a very sort of high level chemist. That does things with like food flavourings.
Wow.
In the big food industry.
Oh my God.
Which is sort of fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, but can you imagine how many times you go, oh God, what I do is quite difficult to explain.
Yeah, and you don't really want to know.
And also, quite a lot of people find it a bit controversial.
Yeah.
That, oh, is that E numbers? And they go, and I just also, I work in food. That's it.
And it's enough.
Yeah, you just have to make a call at the judgment at the time. Are you really asking me what I'm doing? Is that what you really want to know? Or are you asking, or is it something else?
And Yeah, and I think maybe you're the same in terms of not making that choice to do one thing and to want to do more. I mean, so now I sort of feel of that I am a writer and a director. And
I think as well, it takes a while to have the confidence to use those that. Words. Mm, my sister absolutely. Has came to be a teacher later in life. She's been teaching for as a sort of second career. She's probably been teaching for maybe 12 years now. Really only in the last 2 or 3 years would she say, I am a teacher.
Mm.
Before that, if you said, she'd say, well, I did, and then I was qualified, and I worked in this school, and I worked in that. You're a teacher. You are.
You are.
Say it. She used to say, but it's just me. Oh. I stand there and say, but it's just me. And you go, yeah. Well, yeah, but all teachers, it's only just, you know, human beings. But yeah, so I think there is a confidence
thing.
To say, I am a director, that's a big thing.
Yes. And for me, I think the biggest next step will be actually directing something.
Yeah.
So I've done co-directing and I've done assistant directing, and I've done workshop leading and facilitating, but to actually direct something, you know, not my story, but a story or a piece.
Can you imagine, you know, maybe there's in somewhere a little church hall in Manchester, can you imagine Anna actually, you know, instigating, being a producer as well as a director? Or will you be looking for kind of partners to work with in that way? Can you imagine finding a story and saying, right, that's the story I want to tell, or that's the ideas I want to explore, and...
Yes,
being
I can.
A catalyst in that
yes,
way.
Yes, I think so. But I think as you were saying, in terms of taking, again, it's like learning the language, learning any language, or learning anything, being able to actually begin to say it. So I think that it's only a year ago I wouldn't have been able to say I'm a writer, I'm a director.
Yeah.
Now I can say it. Now I can begin to put that into action. So, and it is about confidence, and I don't think you can do it until you believe that it could happen, and B, that you could fail. And
do you know,
okay.
I was just thinking, I wonder where failure fits into
yeah.
this.
And I remember going to a directing workshop a year ago, and there was quite a well-known director next to me, and I was sort of saying, but how do you do it? How do you actually put those ideas together and actually put that intention in? And he said, you have to be willing to fail.
Yeah,
you absolutely have to be willing to fail. And it's that kind of wrestling with that perfection. And we were talking about it earlier in terms of what a podcast is and that kind of, you know, just, you know, pride and all sorts of things.
Yeah, and making yourself vulnerable to exposing this to other people.
Mm.
And... It's taken me a very long time to get to grips with those ideas, and I think this is reflecting on me now. It's so interesting how talking to other people does sort of bring up your own stuff. I have truly come to understand the idea that I was not parented as a child. I simply wasn't, and so I've had to teach myself a lot of things. Give myself a lot of ideas that I know that as a much more active and attentive parent than I had, I know where ideas that get talked about in this house, that get looked at, that get considered, that get, you know, well, like my daughter talking, you know, getting feisty about being the tall one,
in the
rather than being sort of crushed and crumbling away by it. But this, I think getting to grips with those ideas at 27 is an incredible gift. Incredible. Mm. Because you will fail. You will fail. You will. You know, Sam Mendes fails every day. You know, it's that you can point at movies that directors have made that are disasters, or maybe we don't, as the public, we don't know they're disasters, but within them, she made a million compromises, a million things that they wanted to happen that didn't happen, the arguments that happened, relationships that fell apart. We don't see any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Failure happens all the time. And it's not the end of the world.
No.
Nobody will die.
But don't you think, but don't you think that it's is it a culture that we don't talk about? Is it this black
hole?
Oh,
completely. And I think things like the web and the connectivity that gives us.
Mm.
There's some things to be fought against there, like the cult of Pinterest, which is basically, you know, notice boards of people posting pictures of very beautiful things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm planning my wedding, so I want table decorations. Mm-hmm. So here's some pictures of some incredibly beautiful table decorations, which have been styled by, you know, photographic stylists, which are, if you pulled the camera back,
mm.
you'd see mess and cardboard boxes and duct tape and everything else. You know, it's all lies. And the technology, like GarageBand that I'm using today, allows an amateur to put a gloss of professionalism on things, which is perhaps not great. It's not actually very true.
Yeah, that's it.
It's not very real. If people were here having this conversation with us now, they'd see that our clothes are a bit scruffy and the floor's not hoovered and we've got cold coffee and the room's a bit of a mess.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
We could put the allure on it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There was a brilliant Tumblr I saw, you know, like a photographic blog, which was this artist asking other people, she was actually talking about craftspeople, please post a picture of your studio, actually how it is. Don't tidy it up.
Because
often you see, look at my beautiful wool, all in rainbow colours. And that's not what creative people's workspaces look like. That's a load of bullshit. Mm-hmm. That's what they look like in magazines.
Mm-hmm. And that pressure to clean up, you know, to not be messy.
A room of one's own.
Yeah, we've done it all.
God, I love her.
Because, I mean, that's the other thing, is that she's not, in her writing, I talk like she's still alive, but she's not afraid of the mess,
no.
You know?
No.
She doesn't have to simplify. She doesn't... I love her.
Yes, I think I know that. I was mooching through your Facebook timeline yesterday, because, as I don't know anything about you, I didn't until an hour ago. I thought I'd have a look. That's where I saw that beautiful little video, which I will put on the podcast's website, of the baby leading the dancers. How beautiful.
Stunning.
Just to explain, it's three dancers and they're watching this little baby. He's probably about 18 months old, a sort of staggering little baby person. And the three dancers, who I think are professional dancers, they certainly move like professional dancers, are basically following what this baby is doing, the movements of the baby. And I suddenly realised how much of contemporary dance is sort of about, seems to be about, trying to reach this level of freedom and
impulse.
And an impulse that this baby is, because the three adult dancers look like they're doing some choreographed piece of contemporary dance, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, actually what they're doing is copying
following
this little
baby.
Well, it's the same as anything in you know, painting or drawing or anything, about trying to just
get back,
reach that instinctive
place.
Oh. Anyway, that's a whole other something that you said, poetry. I just wanted to come to the question of poetry, and you said that you'd been very inspired by Angela.
Yes.
And her work. Just to tell you, my daughter's name has... And my daughter has Angela as one of her middle names.
Oh.
That's how close Angela... Oh. Angela was there when she was born. So that's how close we are.
Oh, wonderful.
So, yes, tell me about you and poetry, not necessarily about Angela Smangela.
Because
had you really written up to that point?
No.
No?
No! And it's only a year ago that I started writing.
Putting anything down.
Properly. Without it having to be... about theatre, or I'd written at East 15, but it would be writing a monologue for a character in a play, and not sort of being able to go beyond that. And so it was this, you know, amazing man, Matt West, who has sort of built up this whole poetry scene around Southampton. With
Matt is coming in to have a chat with me next week.
Fantastic!
Yay.
What an interesting man.
Really?
What an interesting man. Yeah,
I've no idea. Who he is. I see him hosting spoken word gigs, that's all I know about
him. Yeah, he's led many lives, which perhaps you'll find out about. So, Yes, so I kind of went to one of his workshops, and that forced me in a space with other people to write, and not only to write, but to be given the opportunity to share words and in a supportive environment.
Mm.
And I suppose that was the beginning. I think I was quite shocked at what came out. I didn't sort of feel like I think when you write, you
subject,
start to see yourself.
Or the
yeah,
the individual words,
the style, I suppose. Oh, it was this real sort of what's this? And then I remembered that I had loved creative writing at secondary school, and I had a teacher who, when I had written a piece about Covent Garden, which is my favourite place in the world, or was my favourite place in the world at the time, I wasn't doing that well at school, but I remember doing this piece of creative writing, and she handed it back to me and said, "Is this your own work? Did you have any help in this? I don't believe that you did this."
Wow.
And, you know, my response was very much, okay, well then rather than sort of forcefully, you know.
How dare you, of course it isn't her.
I'd step back.
Yeah.
And it was that kind of response. And I know that for so many artists with kind of broken souls in that way, it's things like that, those kind of interactions that stop people from doing what they might really like to do.
Gosh, there's so much in that.
Yeah.
And what I want to go and poke her in the eye. What an incredibly irresponsible thing to say. Or way to say it, or something.
Mm.
Oh, yes, that's maybe a bit cross now.
Because, you know, if you want to give anything, you know, it comes back to the garden, but like, if you want something to grow, you nourish it, you encourage it, you give it what it needs in order to rise up. And yes, so writing lay untouched for a long time, and it was only in sort of just kind of dangling my feet in the water of it with Matt and his workshop that I just kind of found out more. And how did it? So I suppose I began to write, and I kind of found myself going to more poetry things.
Yes.
And sort of just being this ear.
Just being fed.
Really, really fed.
Bathing in this.
Absolutely.
Washy wash.
Yeah, totally. But also sort of feeling the theatre roots of it as well, and sort of, you know, kind of being able to analyse people's performances and go, well, why am I relating to this person?
Yes.
And what are they communicating to me? And yeah, why does it resonate, I suppose? And so having those kind of, having a theatre background, and but also I think that was the other thing, is that I found myself being really relating to people and their own words more than a sort of distant play.
Right, yes.
And sort of being really struck by the power of these kind of people's own monologues and these own sort of really carefully chosen words. And I think I'm someone that thinks a lot, many, many thoughts, and I think poetry is such a wonderful way to put that into action and to choose your words really well.
So are you sort of writing every day? Or, I mean, you do it... Do you see it as a sort of practice almost? You sit down and say, right, now I'm going to write, or is it...
Yes, I think I'm still finding the form, and I think that's the other thing. Oh, well, yes. I did dabble in poetry in this a little, but then I also, there was should I put this on the book? There was a relationship with a man that definitely brought out emotions into words.
Yes.
For the first time in my life. And suddenly I was able, you know, I'd sort of start writing my feelings about this person or sort of what was happening. And, you know, it was absolutely out of control.
Yes.
Sort
of, your toothpaste tube was being squeezed and...
Yeah! What's this? And it's me, and did I say that? And when that relationship ended, I sort of thought, well, can I still take that? Can I apply that writing to something else? And I think, so that's what really began it. But what really altered that... what's really turned that into a real practice was going to Canada for 3 months and actually saying, well, I'm going to give myself time to write.
I don't think you're 27. I think you're about 57, because I don't think you have time to do all these things. I was in Poland, and then I was in Tanzania, and then I was in Canada.
No.
What was in Canada?
My half-sister, who's in her 50s. My cousin, who I hadn't seen for 14 years, who gave birth to a baby in the middle of the night in the house while I was there.
Wow!
Yeah, bonkers, man.
Were you there when the baby was born?
I was there.
Yeah!
And it's just, I mean, I see mothers now in a completely different way. I look at you and I'm like, you are incredible. And birth is amazing.
I think I have been present at three and a half births in my life. Two births that I was the mother of. One where a friend asked me to be a birth partner, and a half of one where I arrived a bit after Angela's baby was born. But I think if anybody is ever, ever asked to go and be somebody's birth partner, just say yes.
Do it.
Just say yes.
Do it.
It is a life
affirming.
Also, the day, God forbid it comes soon, but if you are, get the opportunity to be with somebody as they die, it is a... I mean, what else is there? You know, birth, death, this is the stuff of
life.
Us all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Never be afraid of it.
No.
Go and see it, because it, yeah.
And if you wonder what reality is, that's
that's the realest thing you can possibly imagine, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Oh. So this all happened when you were in Canada?
This all happened when I was in Canada. And then, and I also spent a month in a yoga ashram while I was there too.
God.
So, you know, it was a mixed it up experience. And yeah, so I was trying to write throughout that. There were times when I wasn't, but I was very much giving myself the permission to do that and not do other things for the first time.
So
I think it's about giving yourself permission. And then when I came back from Canada, I actually, you know, did my first open mic and actually spoke my first poem. I think it's a real
and
journey.
And how did that feel? Was it the most terrifying thing of your life ever?
Yeah, it was.
Even for someone who'd been a performer since she was seven,
it's so much more naked. It's so, your own words are so much more naked, but there's something really compelling about that. And I think that you do, when you write, you are finding out who you are, or seeing who you are.
I love that thing when you hear yourself say something and then you think, good Lord, I didn't know I thought that. I just said, that was a really wise thing, or that was really profound. Good Lord. And it's not, and it needs to come out. It needs to come out of your own mouth and into your own ears before you actually really hear it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what any sort of talking therapy about, isn't it?
Mm.
Just say, getting it out of your brain, out of your unconscious brain, and let your ears hear yourself say it.
So, yeah, absolutely. Don't let thoughts be sort of
contained. And let get that loopy, flowing process go. Yeah, I mean, easier said than done, but...
Sure.
But once so is that something... So, I'm now extremely sad that you're moving to Manchester, because... But as, you know, it's only 3¾ hours away, and I will be coming in February-ish time, because I'm coming up to see my brother in Seagull. Ha, ha, ha!
Great.
So we will come and have a nice cup of tea.
Yes,
I might even see if I can get you to come and see.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, they don't get free tickets, unfortunately, in the library. But I think he gets like 10% off or something. Okay. But we'll go to a matinee or something.
Yeah, sure.
The days of actors getting free blooming tickets seems to be long gone. I suppose it depends how well it's selling, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Should we see when we get?
Yeah. And it also, I think it depends on who it is that you're. You know, there's so many different people that can affect whether you get a seat in a theatre or not.
Indeed.
You've got the actors, you've got the, you know, the stage manager, you've got the front of house manager, you've got the...
Yeah.
AD, artistic director, blah, 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 blah.
Blah, 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 blah. But it seems to me that you are carrying with you a huge bag of, you know, beautiful jewels that you're taking to Manchester with you, of these experiences and these... it feels like there's lots of little tentacles, reaching vines that are reaching out and you know, one of them or several of them are going to find something to sort of perch on. And well, it kind of feels pretty impossible that they won't, really. I know there to be a busy creative scene in Manchester. You already know people there. You've got your old lady house that you're going to go and live in. Where is your old lady house? Which area?
In Chorlton.
Chorlton's lovely!
Yeah. So, and I feel
I had... I had breakfasty brunch at the Steam... No, the Lead Room. Okay. Really nice pub in Chorlton. And there's the most beautiful clothes shop that I want to go back to. Where this woman, she's a maker singer. Oh. And her husband's a musician. And he plays with Bjork. And that was all really cool conversation. She seemed really nice. Her shop's called Trouble at Mill.
Oh, wonderful.
So,
wonderful name.
Having only really probably met you today on my sofa.
Yeah.
Having sung with you. We should say that. We did our wonderful, we had our lovely Hallelujah, which we're going to get to do one more time before you go away.
Yes.
Maybe we'll just do it in Manchester. Stand on the street. No, we need the other two to do it. So I'm really pleased that, you know, having just met you today properly, that we can continue our conversation.
Absolutely.
When we get to Manchester. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, there you go, Podcats. That was the delightful Anna Carr with and her astonishing TARDIS life. I can't believe the quantity of fascinating things she's packed it into a mere 27 years. And another person who doesn't really think she does enough. I think that's part of the human condition, isn't it? We are our own worst critics, but it's fantastic for me that having got to know her a bit recently and really enjoying her company, I'm not going to lose her on her journey up to Manchester. So that's me done for another week. This podcast will come out to you on a Thursday, by which time I will have had what I hope is going to be an interesting meeting about a poetry festival that I'm hoping to get involved in later on in the year, so I should be able to tell you a bit about that. I will also be having a job interview, which I'm not telling too many people about yet because it feels like it jinxes it a little bit, but might share that with you, see how it goes. I'll also be enjoying my continued relationship with Danny Dyer on EastEnders, who makes some very enjoyable viewing because it turns out he can act. Who knew? Beautiful scene with his son the other night. And it turns out also that my California sister is an EastEnders obsessive. So that is a lovely way that we can continue our reinvigorated sisterhood that we found over Christmas. Next week I hope to be talking to Matt West about poetry and spoken word and his incredible work in developing the poetry scene in Southampton, which is really incredibly vibrant now. That's not a 100% cert yet. I do hope that I will be able to lock in a schedule of interviews so I can actually tell you with some confidence from week to week who you can expect to listen to. And as the new year spreads out ahead of us, I hope I can wheedle my way into people's diaries. But as I said at the top of the show, if you've got ideas for guests that you think would make good interviewees, please do put them forward to me. I'm always delighted to have interesting conversations with interesting people. Find us on the show's website at nobitspod.com. Follow me on Twitter at nobitspod, or Facebook, Smooth Style No Bits Podcast. So that about wraps it up. So keep warm, keep dry, but get out in it. It's quite exciting as long as you're involved in Avoid the Falling Trees. Me and the doggy had a fantastic walk this afternoon. So it's been a joy as ever, and talk to you next week. Bye.